This episode of China Money Podcast is sponsored by Lehman Brown, a China accounting, audit, and advisory firm. Golden Gate, a law firm providing a full range of legal services in China. Covert Limited, a leading internet privacy tool. And 51mice.com, a comprehensive online platform for meetings, incentives, conferences, and exhibitions in China. Please go to our website, chinamoneynetwork.com, and click on our sponsors' links. Thank you so much, everyone, for your support. Hello, everyone. Welcome to China Money Podcast. I'm your host, Nina Xiang. Our guest today is Hamilton Tang, managing partner of SMC Capital China, a private equity firm focused on the Chinese consumer space. Tang spoke with me earlier in Hong Kong on the sidelines of the HKVCA Asia Private Equity Forum 2017. He talked about his firm's investment in the Chinese horse racing and trading company, Rider House Company Limited, as well as its investment in cross-border e-commerce players and food and beverage companies. Here is our conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Hello, Hamilton. Welcome to China Money Podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So, SMC Capital, give us a two-sentence description. What sets you apart from other fund managers?
So we have been, for the last 14 years and counting, a dedicated China private equity specialist. I think this makes us certainly one of the early goers. So we started our business way back in 2003. We've seen a lot in the years between then and now, the ups and the downs, the cycles. Today we, and for the last few years, we have really been focused on the consumer sector. In China, we are growth stage, typically Series A lead investors. Of course, the consumer sector itself is very broad, but we try to focus our time and deepen our knowledge and experience within particular areas of the consumer universe in China. Number one, we have a common theme that is really centered around the what we call the upwardly mobile, aspirational, upgrading middle-class consumer in China. And within that space, we look for high-growth companies, consumer companies that service the upwardly mobile, aspirational consumer, especially in two regards. One, where the marriage of technology and the consumer experience produces a really differentiated outcome. So we're big believers that technology is really enabling this consumer revolution in China. And secondly, because of the background of our shareholders and over the years having worked with some very significant family offices out of Europe with industrial backgrounds, we also emphasize very much cross-border work. So we look for companies and for founders, entrepreneurs that share our view that an otherwise purely domestic Chinese consumer company can be raised to new levels through engagement with counterparts outside of China, be they within the Asia region or internationally in Europe, etc. And I believe we have the network and the experience to back up this point of emphasis.
Are you structured in a regular fund structure? Like you have LPs?
Mm-hmm. So we have done a bit of both over the years. We've had sort of co-investment pockets. We've deployed our own balance sheet. But mainly, we have GP-LP funds, so kind of a very standard, traditional arrangement.
So how many funds you manage?
So at the moment, we've had three private equity funds of this nature, GP-LP, over the years. Previously, as I mentioned, we also had some co-investment pots with using our own balance sheet and select investors from our network. So this is the third Our current fund is the third private equity fund that we've been managing.
Has
a GP LP structure.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Have the first fund already fully exited?
Yeah. So, you know, the first fund was some time ago. It was 03-04 in joint venture with some very good friends of mine under the brand of Milestone, Milestone Capital. Milestone 1 was very successful. We delivered just under 5x to our investors. We had a very
over 10 to 10 years?
No. So over the years, if you look at our results, I think one of the things we pride ourselves on is our DPI, distributions over paid in. So for example, our latest fund, which is vintage 2011, so within the investment period, we have a DPI of over 1. We have 1.1x. So if you look at industry data that we've seen from Preqin and from Cambridge Associates, the upper quartile for 2011 vintage China funds DPI seems to be 0.2 to 0.3x. So we are a good, you know, 4, in some cases maybe even 5x better than the upper quartile. Right. Put another way, we invested in
this fund,
14 companies.
Yeah.
We have exited fully 5 and partially exited 2. So half the portfolios within the investment period has been fully or partially realized.
When you said 5 times for fund 1, that wasn't DPI, right?
That's money on money return, not okay. DPI. Yeah.
So how much capital you manage currently?
All right. So we have a number of different platforms. In the aggregate, we have about 700-800 million US in AUM. Our most recent private equity fund, vintage 2011, was 100 million, and we launched last year our third fund in our private equity history with 40 million US, and we have a target of 100 to 200 when all is said and done.
So let's talk about some of your investments specifically.
Sure.
And those industries.
Yeah.
One of the interesting companies that you've invested is a horse breeding and racing club operator in China called Inner Mongolia Rider Horse Industry.
Yes.
Which you invested back in 2012.
That's right.
Tell us a little bit about how this company has been growing in the past few years.
Sure. I would say since our investment, the company has increased revenues by more than 6x. That said, I think what is even more important is that the composition of the revenues, so the revenue mix, is substantially different. So in 2012, we were attracted to the equestrian industry in general as part of our focus on the upgrading middle-class consumer. So our observation was that Chinese moms were no longer content with sending their children just to violin lessons or swimming lessons, and that we saw more and more interest in sending their kids to riding academies. I think this was also the case post-2008 Beijing Olympics. If you look, the number of horse clubs in China really skyrocketed. Okay, so but the issue was that no school in particular was large enough, in our opinion, and we couldn't quite see how we could scale the business to a platform. But in the course of our work, we came across, through an introduction, the founder of Rider, which is based in Inner Mongolia, as you said, Lang Zong, Mr. Lang. And he had been a very successful restaurant hot pot entrepreneur, but his real passion was in horses. But when we met him in 2011-2012, the business was entirely a trading business, meaning that in effect the business model was buy horse X at A and sell at B. And our view was that inevitably a trading business would face more competition and margin and compression. So we did not think that it was a sustainable business model. Fortunately, I think Lang Zong agreed with our assessment. And so with our help, particularly back to the cross-border engagement, the company today is much, much more diversified. So we have still a horse buying and selling business, But we also today have a very strong breeding program. We are the largest importer of horses from New Zealand, so we have a very large import quarantine business. As you may know, under the Chinese regulations, imported horses are required to undergo quarantine. We also have, through joint ventures with different overseas companies, a horse or equine immunization business, so vaccinations, as well as a horse transportation business. And as you mentioned, we today are probably the most successful horse racing sports event organizer in the country. So of course, the government does not allow wagering, betting, but still there have been more and more horse races, and Ryder has been very much a big part of organizing those. And hopefully later this year, we will be rolling out a foreign-branded horse feed product as well, in joint venture with another New Zealand company. So we have taken this company and really changed the nature of the business. We have made, I think, some key introductions for Lang Zong to allow him to tap into, particularly into Australia and New Zealand. And so we're quite excited. The company is now targeting to file for an IPO this first quarter. Of course,
In Shanghai or Shenzhen?
Yes, in the third board.
Oh, third board.
In the third board. As you know, with any Shanghai or Shenzhen, any listing, there's of course a queue. But one thing I think we have, Ryder is the first company in Inner Mongolia to have received significant foreign investment. And I think in many ways we are a model for the Inner Mongolian government. So we very much have their support. I hope I'm not speaking out of turn in, their support in trying to move through the IPO queue on a fast track basis.
Yeah. Well, listing on new third board is different from listing on the Shenzhen or Shanghai board.
Actually, to be fair, we haven't fully decided yet.
Right.
So I say that it could
just
be
a plan.
Yeah, it could be third board. It could be Shanghai or Shenzhen. There's different plans right now.
So how many horses does the company import every year?
Oh, I don't have the precise figure, but I believe it's a couple hundred. It's quite a big business.
So this is the biggest part of the profit for the company, right?
Yes, I would say, well, the importation, quarantine, immunization, and transport we treat as one because they're all sort of interrelated. So that would probably be the biggest revenue component.
Is it difficult to sell horses in China?
No, so I think that it's very interesting. There are different product lines, if you will. So there are purebred imported horses, thoroughbreds or quarter horses. Also, there are mixed breed horses. So one interesting horse that the company has developed is sort of a mix between the Mongolian pony and an imported quarter horse. So the Mongolian pony is smaller in size, so perhaps more fitting the Chinese population, but also very sturdy, so very tough, can be in extreme climate and so, but not very docile, so not used to humans, not gentle with children, whereas quarter horses have the right temperament. So we create a mixed breed that's very, very affordable to the mass market. And what we found is, as I was saying, there's been a huge increase in the number of riding academies, equestrian clubs, polo facilities. Many, many, as you probably know, high-end residential developments in China today have stables, have polo facilities, have riding rings. It's all part of this, aspirational, creating something that would perhaps mimic, an aristocratic way of life in the UK or in Europe. So, in fact, there's quite a strong demand for horses. And beyond that, eventually our goal is to also offer a horse management service in the same way Hilton and, say, Marriott have a hotel management service. So if you are a developer and you have a stable, but you know, the question is, where do you get the horse? You know, how do you keep it healthy? How do you train it? You know, so Rider really wants to be a one-stop solution to not only provide the horse, but provide the services and infrastructure to get the horse to the development, to take care of it, to feed it, to train it, to help you know, residents learn how to ride, etc., etc. So really a total turnkey solution.
Has the growth in the Chinese equestrian industry been as fast as you expected?
Yeah, I think I have to check as against our original projections, but I can say, I suppose the bottom line is that we were Series A investors, the biggest the biggest shareholder of the company outside of the founder, Mr. Long, in 2012. Since Series A, there have been three subsequent up rounds, B, C, and D. The last round was around an 8x to our entry valuation, and the underwriters for the planned IPO have a, I can't really disclose, but a much, much more robust figure than even the last Series D round. We have, back to my DPI point, taken some chips off the table. So we've sold in subsequent rounds to recoup our principal, but we are still the largest external shareholder, and so hopefully we'll be able to capture the remaining upside once the company is listed.
So let me just confirm, because in 2012, you invested about 60 million yuan in the joint venture, right? The Inner Mongolia rider horse industry. That's correct?
No. We invested 22 million renminbi.
So another portfolio company for SMC Capital is Yamato, which is a cross-border e-commerce player in China. As we know, since China launched this, issued this new regulation, strengthening oversight for cross-border e-commerce, how has that impacted the company's business?
Yeah, so I would give you a brief answer to this, which is, first, I think the regulations are still being fine-tuned. So ultimately, I think we don't have all the answers. No one does. I think Yamato and all the cross-border e-commerce companies are still adapting to these changes, which are evolving as we speak. I think the overall intent is not to eliminate the cross-border e-commerce industry, but rather to try to level the playing field. And to that extent, we are very supportive of it. Obviously, there were some fits and starts, but I think the bottom line is that Yamato is still serving literally millions of Chinese consumers, and it's a bit wait and see on how the regulations ultimately pan out.
Did the regulation already negatively impact the company?
Yeah,
finances?
For a period of time, but then I think there was a rebound, so that, you know, there was a period of adoption period, but then, you know, business has picked up again.
Would the company adjust, you know, any adjustment to how it operates?
There were, obviously, you know, we have to comply with the new regulations, so there was a period to adjust with the, you know, in terms of compliance. Yeah.
Okay, so let's move on to healthcare.
Sure.
Which is a major sector that you yep. focus on. So one of the business you backed is a supplement e-commerce retailer.
Yes. Yeah.
Could you explain a little bit of the rationale behind the investment?
Sure. Yeah, so as I mentioned, within the consumer universe, we look for companies that typically have at least one, if not two, traits. One is that they really use technology to differentiate the consumer experience. And two is where we and they share a view that cross-border accessibility will be very important to building value. Okay, so in the case of this company you're alluding to called EC Moho, this is today the largest really e-tailer of health supplements and nutrients in China. Okay, and satisfies both of the criteria I mentioned. If you look overall at the supplements and nutrients industry. It's very, very large. I have to get back to you. I can't remember the size, but it's a very big industry. As you know, if nothing else, TCM has been part of, you know, Chinese culture and practice for many, many years. So this sort of awareness of supplements and nutrients is, I would say, almost culturally instilled as well. Today, it's true that the vast majority of sales are done through neighborhood mom-and-pop, you know, pharmacies. And the online interface is only about 15% plus or minus. However, this is by far the fastest growing channel. And so our view is that more and more consumers are understanding the power of being able to, you know, order and ultimately have orders fulfilled by an online player like Isimoho, because obviously we offer far more choice. We offer much better value, and we have the convenience of basically delivering it to your home. Okay, so the online channel in general is growing fastest in China in health supplements and nutrients, and our investee company is the largest player. Now, the second way in which, and so largely leveraging, obviously, the internet. The second aspect worth highlighting is cross-border. So the company has for some time now been in different varying relationships, but essentially representing some of the top overseas brands. So Johnson & Johnson, Puritan's Pride, Nature's Bounty. Actually, Puritan's Pride is part of Nature's Bounty. Wyatt, Sanofi, and, you know, so the list goes on and on. And so as well, representing very well-known domestic TCM brands. So it has this nice mix of cross-border representing overseas brands as well as domestic brands.
What is the future for this type of vertical e-commerce platforms?
Yeah, I think, you know, there are some important competitive skills to stay ahead in this industry. One is that I think, as with so many other businesses we look at, data is huge. So we have now a database of 5-6 million consumers. I think, you know, the company has and hopefully will continue to improve its ability to understand what this, you know, installed base of consumers wants. In other words, fingers on the pulse of your customer. So more and more, apart from representing very notable international brands, there are niche markets that we're pursuing where perhaps the product is underrepresented in China. So for example, we're now, there's a number of very interesting products from Japan that we believe will be popular, very niche things, everything relating from, you know, honey to aphrodisiacs to the whole range. So I think that's one. I think the other important strategic initiative is, in a very selective manner, partnering with established brands to create almost an OEM business. So there's, you probably know, quite a well-known Chinese TCM brand, Tongrentang. Mm-hmm. And so last year we started some trials of OEM products under the Tongrentang, and we actually have a joint venture with them now in this respect. So I think it's both, you know, understanding the data you have and coming up with, you know, more products, niche products included, that the customers want, and selectively, you know, creating your own white label brands in partnership with established traditional brands.
I mean, we have seen Alibaba buying some, you know, specialized vertical e-commerce platforms. Do you feel like, you know, like independent, specific industry-focused e-commerce platforms will always be around, or there is emerging consolidation?
Yeah, I mean, I think if Mr. Ma or Mr. Tsai are listening to this, please feel welcome to buy our company. But no, I think there's always, you know, room for horizontal players as well as specialists, vertical specialists. And I think that to the degree we can build EC Moho to continue to build it towards critical mass, yeah, at some point it might be an attractive strategic target for some of the bigger horizontal players. As well, you probably know there are some vertical e-tailers that have already listed. So, for example, you know, there's Lillian Beauty that's listed in the States and so on. That is a vertical e-tailer in cosmetics. So I think, you know, whether the capital markets or a trade sale, but, you know, it's not so easy to be a vertical specialist, to build relationships, to know the domain. And I think EC Moho's management team has accumulated this.
Well, I see you have a bunch of healthcare company, like portfolio companies, but I don't think your firm is known for healthcare-related investments. I think it's more like entertainment and sports, right?
Yeah, so I think we have, we are not per se a healthcare specialist fund. We are not per se an education fund. Although we have invested in education, we have invested in healthcare. Overall, as I said, we are consumer guys, but we do look for, you know, the technology-enabled feature and the cross-border. And out of that, we do have certain preferred subsectors that we keep revisiting, hopefully to increase our knowledge. So this includes, and it's interesting that many of these revolve around the woman. So we actually believe the Chinese woman is at the center of this consumer revolution in China. If nothing else, she is typically the secretary of the treasury in the household, right? So she controls key spending decisions as it relates to healthcare and education, but also beauty products. We like the travel and leisure segment. We like the payment space. We think we've built up some competence there. We like the mobile space. So these are all areas that we tend to revisit specific subsectors within the consumer universe that have sort of either a technology-enabled and or cross-border feature.
Can we talk another company called Vimeo?
Yeah, sure, Vimeo.
Is that the representative?
Yeah, Vimeo is one of my favorite companies. Terrific fellow running it, Mr. Su Dong. We actually sold our position already in Vimeo, so we're no longer shareholders, but we had a very good experience, and we made good money on exiting. I would say, in short, Vimeo was, at the time we sold it, the biggest franchising business of sort of Japanese-style sweets and other dessert products. We always viewed it as a pipeline business, though, meaning that, you know, Sue had built the pipes. So it was a question of always filling, it was a platform play, and filling the pipes with different products and concepts. So we did everything from cream puffs to Japanese style cheesecake, and to octopus, grilled octopus balls, to yogurt drinks, all sharing the same commonality, which is central kitchen, small, easy to prepare food items in kiosks, and so that was the basic premise.
So Honey Capital, you know, is one of the typical, like, very high-profile Chinese private equity investors betting a lot on the restaurant business.
Yeah.
But you haven't made another investment in the like snack food or restaurant type business, right? Why?
Yeah. So I, you know, well, first of all, I have a lot of respect for Honey Capital, and in many ways, I hope we can learn from them. I can learn from them as an individual, and we can learn from them as a GP, but I think we did not, although Vimeo happened to be in selling food items, to us it was never really an F&B play in the sense that it was, as I say, much more about the distribution pipeline. In general, our experience and looking at some of the F&B plays that have been supported by private equity, in our humble opinion, it is a difficult space. You know, it's a cash business principally. a lot of potential for leakage in the system. You also have the issue of an increasingly difficult retail brick and mortar environment, sensible leasing economics. So we have not taken a deep dive into the F&B, into the restaurant space. We've actually looked at deals, but we haven't pulled the trigger, in part because of this, general angst about some of the, particularities of this industry.
So if you can picture a company in the F&B space that you could invest in, what would the business be?
I think that one thing, like everyone else that we've looked at, although we've tried to find the right way to express this, obviously food safety is a huge issue in China. I think necessarily, unfortunately, the domestic audience is jaded, tired of anything made in China. I think there's almost an inherent mistrust. So I suppose if there is a F&B play, it would be to look at companies that perhaps addressing the new healthy generation with really embracing food safety. But as I say, I think traditional restaurant formats are quite difficult, particularly on a widespread scale business because of the nature. It's a cash business. And, at least in our limited experience, with a lot of potential for leakage. So probably some sort of digital interface or in smaller concepts like what Vimeo had.
As you screen deals and potential investment targets, where do you find the most attractive companies nowadays?
I think that what happens is that by focusing on a few specific subsectors like beauty, like financial services and payments I mentioned, like travel and tourism. Hopefully you build up a network and you become known as a player in that space. So we actually, like the Ryder investment, wasn't because we started straight away by saying, okay, we need to be in the horse training business. But because we started looking around in horse academies, riding schools, that led us through a contact to Longzong. So it's really, I think there's a networking effect by being focused on specific subsectors.
Thank you so much, Hamilton, for your time.
Thank you, Nina. It was a pleasure meeting you, and I hope we can continue our dialogue.